Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, April 3rd. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Pam Rhodes and Patty Daniels. Here's our first story from the front page of the QC Times. Woman sentenced for voter fraud by Nick Heitrich of the Sioux City Journal. Sioux City, facing up to 5 years in prison on each of 52 counts of voter fraud, Kim Taylor took a few moments before her sentencing Monday for what could have been a last hug with her children, husband, and mother for a long time. A little more than an hour later, she was able to share a few more hugs outside the federal courthouse in Sioux City before heading home. She'll be going to prison, but not immediately, and not for nearly as long as was possible. Chief U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand sentenced Taylor, the wife of Republican Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, to a rare split sentence, 4 months in prison and 4 months of home confinement on each count, all served concurrently or at the same time. She'll serve 2 years of supervised release under the U.S. Probation Office after completing her sentence and must pay a $5,200 special assessment, $100 for each count. She will remain out of custody before being directed to self-surrender at a later date designated by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Taylor, 50, of Sioux City, has faced a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison on each charge, but the federal sentencing guidelines, which employ a formula that takes numerous factors into account, resulted in an advisory guideline range of 18 to 24 months per count for Strand to consider when making his sentencing decision. Strand said Taylor's lack of criminal history and her role as a chief caretaker for 6 children and her 78-year-old mother were factors in his choosing a sentence lower than the advisory guidelines, but her crimes were concerning. It does undermine confidence in the voting process, Strand said. Certainly, votes were cast that would not have been cast but for Ms. Taylor's conduct. Taylor declined the opportunity to make a statement to the court before she was sentenced. Kim Taylor's attorney, F. Montgomery Brown, had asked for a sentence of 9 months home confinement rather than incarceration, but plus 100 hours of community service. Taylor's crimes were those of over-exuberance and excessive excitement for her husband and other candidates' campaigns, he said, and not ones of violence or ongoing public questioning of voting security. According to court records, she didn't storm the Capitol. She didn't participate in the Stop the Steal myth, Brown said, in reference to the January 6, 2021 riot in Washington, D.C., amid claims, all since debunked, that Joe Biden's presidential election victory over Donald Trump was the result of election shenanigans by Democrats. The main issue has been trying to reduce the potential amount of incarceration, Brown said after the sentencing hearing. For Kim, I'm pleased that the judge granted a very large downward variance from the recommended sentence. Government prosecutors had asked for a sentence above the suggested range to send a proper message of deterrence in this case, Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Evans said. The nature and circumstances of the offense are particularly egregious in this case, Evans said. To this day, the defendant has failed to take responsibility for her conduct that was borne out at trial. There is no indication of remorse or contrition, just denial. Prosecutors declined to comment on the sentence. A jury in November found Taylor guilty of 26 counts of providing false information in registering and voting, 3 counts of fraudulent registration, and 23 counts of fraudulent voting. throughout the 2020 election cycle, first before the primary election and then again in advance of the general election, Taylor met with Vietnamese voters with limited English comprehension living in Woodbury County and filled out and signed election forms and ballots on behalf of them and their English-speaking children. Her actions were a scheme, prosecutors said, to secure significant numbers of votes for her husband, who ran unsuccessfully for the Republican nomination for a U.S. House seat in the 2020 primary before winning election to the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors that fall. Woodbury County election officials became aware of possible voter fraud in September 2020 when two Iowa State University students from Sioux City requested absentee ballots, only to learn ballots had already been cast in their name. They were allowed to withdraw those ballots and cast their own. But Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill, who also is the county's election commissioner, kept the fraudulent ballots. When processing absentee ballots on election night, election workers notified Gill the handwriting on a number of them appeared to be similar. After the election, Gill notified the FBI, which launched an investigation. Taylor, a Vietnam native, was indicted and arrested in January 2023. Jeremy Taylor, who met his wife while teaching in Vietnam, has not been charged, but was named in court filings in his wife's case as an unindicted co-conspirator. During the six-day trial in U.S. District Court in Sioux City, five voters who had immigrated from Vietnam and speak very little English testified through a translator that Kim Taylor had frequently visited their homes with voter registration forms, absentee request forms, and absentee ballots. Taylor helped the voters fill out forms and ballots, and in some cases filled them out for the voters. She also told them they could complete and sign forms for their children without their consent. One man said he'd hand over all the blank forms to Taylor, who would leave with them. Eight young adults, the sons and daughters and a granddaughter of those five witnesses, who all were born in Sioux City and speak English, each testified they had never given consent for their parents to fill out election forms for them and were unaware that they had done so. Many of them said they'd never voted. In one case, two of the men hadn't lived in Sioux City for several years and weren't eligible to vote here. Yet voter registration forms, absentee requests, and ballots bearing their mother's Sioux City addresses were filled in there with their names. Before announcing his sentence, Strand acknowledged the political undertones present in the case. Was it possible, Strand asked prosecutors, that Taylor's prosecution, given the large number of charges, was politically driven because she and her husband are Republicans and the Biden administration is now in charge of the U.S. Justice Department? Evans said in 17 years, he's never seen a suspect's political affiliation play a role in cases his division brings forward for prosecution. Our office is charged with going after all forms of corruption. It doesn't matter if it's red or blue or Democrat or Republican, Evans said. Political affiliation does not enter into the cases we bring. We follow the evidence and prosecute it. With sentencing completed, Taylor has 14 days to file an appeal of her conviction. Ms. Taylor will be evaluating her options as to any appeal, Brown said. Jeremy Taylor continues to sit on the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors, but did not file for re-election for his seat by the March 22nd deadline. Jeremy Taylor declined to comment beyond Brown's statements after the hearing, saying he was going to go home to take care of his family. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Timmons declined to say if the case remains under investigation or if other indictments are anticipated.
Dogplex Daycare opens in Moline. A new spot to drop off canine friends has opened in Moline. The Dogplex, 400 24th Street in Moline, is a doggy daycare and boarding facility specializing in care for smaller animals. Opening the facility fulfills a longtime dream for Harold DeFries. With three dogs of his own, he's done research on dog resorts in the area and couldn't find what he was looking for. Some places were too fancy and some didn't seem to have enough space or equipment. I could only find the extremes, so I wanted to open one that felt like a home, he said. I just love dogs. I always have. DeFries said the state does not regulate how many dogs he's allowed to have in his facility, but he plans to put up an emphasis on small and medium-sized animals, considering the size of the space. Eventually, he plans to fence a portion of the outdoor area to allow the dogs to roam freely. Until then, they will be leashed for walks and potty breaks. The Dogplex will also offer overnight boarding with a staff member on site 24/7. Grooming will be offered down the line, he said. Kennels have been set up in a separate room to allow the dogs a quiet, safe place to eat and relax if needed. Additional rooms with smaller kennels and couches are meant for dogs who may need alone time before going back to play with the other canines. A board is set up at the entrance for staff to keep track of what dogs do during the day, and cameras will eventually be set up to allow owners to peek in on what their animal is up to. All dogs are required to have their distemper and rabies vaccines before staying. Owners are welcome to bring in their own food, or Dogplex can provide it for an additional fee. Starting out, daycare has a cost of $25 a day and boarding $50 a day. The first day is always free, and you can bring your dog down as long as you have the paperwork, DeFries says. The Dogplex will be open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., with boarding offered 7 days a week. More information can be found at www.dogplex.com or by calling 563-200-6024.
Davenport, man charged with murder. Written for us by Jeff Reinitz of the Courier. Cedar Falls, a Davenport man has been charged in a 2022 fatal shooting in Cedar Falls that claimed the life of a Clear Lake resident. Bean Bradley Ekstrom, 31, is charged with first-degree murder, felon in possession of a firearm, and intimidation with a weapon. He was transferred to the Black Hawk County Jail on Monday after he was released from prison on unrelated charges. Authorities allege Ekstrom was one of the people involved in the February 6, 2022 shooting on College Street that resulted in the death of 19-year-old Arthur Craig Lang of Clear Lake. Prosecutors described that incident as a chance encounter between two groups that didn't know each other and erupted in a gunfight around closing time in the College Hill area. According to court records, Ekstrom and a friend were standing in the area of the G parking lot in the 2200 block of College Street around 1:45 a.m. An SUV containing Lang and others from the Mason City Clear Lake area pulled up to the two. Holtz began talking to people in the vehicle, and at some point, shooting broke out with Ekstrom firing at people in the vehicle, court records allege. Lang was hit and driven to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Holt was also injured by gunfire and suffered a partially severed spine, according to police. Ekstrom fled and hid his handgun, which investigators later found, records show. They also found seven spent shell casings where he had been standing during the shooting. One of the people from the vehicle, Brandon Javon Mitchell, was arrested for attempted murder, intimidation with a weapon, and prohibited person in possession of a firearm. His trial is tentatively set for July. Another Daniel Martez Hudon 4 pleaded to intimidation with a weapon and was sentenced to up to 10 years in prison. Court records show Ekstrom has prior convictions in Scott County for lascivious acts with a child, failure to register as a sex offender, and criminal mischief for damaging his GPS monitoring device.
This is an article about Eldridge, the town of Eldridge. Utility board hires independent firm. Firm to look into allegations against city utility employees. Eldridge's Electric and Water Utility Board will hire its own firm to investigate allegations against city utility employees who were placed on leave in an ongoing rift between the board and city administration. The board voted 4-0 Monday to hire Josie Lewis Consulting at $200 an hour to do an independent investigation of city allegations. It's unclear the precise scope of the city's allegations against two utility employees, Utility Director Jacob Rao and Clerk Jody Kaufman, who were placed on leave in March. According to the minutes of a special city council meeting, March 27, Mayor Frank King said several utility employees were placed on paid leave pending an investigation into their misconduct, which involves allegations involving financial improprieties and unauthorized use of utility funds. City Administrator Nevada Lemke previously told the Quad City Times, "The employees were placed on leave so we could take a good look at this thing." She said that after a utility employee's W-4 had been inputted incorrectly, leading him to owe more money on his taxes than expected, and that in general the city administration felt there needed to be more oversight of the utility operations and finances. Nicole Prush, an attorney with the Des Moines-based law firm Dickinson, Bradshaw, Fowler, and Hagen, which the board hired, estimated it would take between 20 and 40 hours for the investigator to do an interview and write a report. "We have to have an unbiased opinion on what is happening with the utility employees," Acting Chair Paula Stewart said. Another board member, Craig Garrels, suggested the group table hiring until the next meeting, but Stewart disagreed, saying she didn't believe the board had anything to gain from waiting, since the board previously agreed they wanted an independent investigation. Prush advised the board that delaying the investigation could run the risk of the city taking action without an answer from the board. "Obviously, you've got two people that are on leave, and so you're paying two individuals to be on leave pending an investigation," said Prosh, adding that the utility would likely want its investigation back before the city takes any actions out of its own investigation. Board members also expressed concerns over whether staffing of the utility system was adequate with two employees on leave. Ultimately, the board decided not to take action at Monday night's meeting related to staffing. But they did hear from Troy DeJude, the executive director at the Iowa Association of Municipal Utilities, which represents 754 municipal broadband, electric, gas, and water utilities statewide, on resources the association provides municipal utilities. DeJude said his organization represents 135 electric utilities, and 59 of them are board-run, and 76 are departments of the city. "We see it run both ways and run very well," DeJude said. Eldridge, he said, is the 13th largest electrical municipal utility of those 135. Of the top 20 largest electrical municipal utilities, 14 are board-governed and 6 are city council-governed, DeJude said. "It is not uncommon to see concerns between the board-run and councils and communities where it's board-run Jude said, but I have never seen a situation where the utility doesn't have its own EIN, in other words, employee identification number. I'm not aware of any that don't. At some point, Rowe was exploring whether to apply for a separate employee identification number for the utility and go with its own insurance provider when the city's insurance policy provider declined to renew coverage for the city. Everything in our world exists on a continuum, I would tell people, DeJude said. The larger you are, the more clear the separation is. If you go to Cedar Falls or Muscatine or Waverly, some of the bigger ones, you'll see much more delineation between the board-run utility and the city-run operations. DeJude said there is still some level of coordination, including sharing of equipment, depending on the size of the city. He added that several member utilities receive insurance coverage provided by the association, while their respective city receives insurance coverage from another company. The association provides operational assistance mostly in natural gas areas. The utility has two certified pipeline welders on staff and provides services for very small municipal gas utilities that can't afford their own staff. The association also employs 3 electric line workers, DeJude said, but they mostly conduct training. Sometimes the association can act as a contractor when members suddenly lose a staffer in a key position, DeJude said. The association can contract one of its staffers or bring in a retired municipal employee with the right expertise.
Crews respond to underground fire. There are 2 photographs here, very large ones of smoke in what is obviously a downtown street. Sarah Watson wrote this for us. She's from the Quad City Times. An underground electrical fire closed the intersection of Harrison and 3rd Street in downtown Davenport Tuesday evening. Smoke billowed from manhole covers, periodic flames shot up, and loud bangs scared pedestrians walking by. We have what we believe to be an electrical fire in an underground vault, an underground electrical conduit. So what we have to do is to wait for Mid-American to secure the power before we can take any additional action. Davenport Fire Department Assistant Chief Rob MacDougall said, Harrison and 3rd will be closed until further notice. In a media release sent around 7:30 p.m., Davenport Fire Department said Harrison Street was closed between 4th and 2nd Streets, and 3rd Street was closed from Ripley to Main. Streetlights in the area were also out, and these intersections could be treated as 4-way stops. All you can do is stand by. They have to make sure the power is completely killed, confirm it, and more than likely the fire is going to go out on its own. If not, it'd be easy to extinguish at that point, MacDougall said. Mid-American's outage map showed more than 5,700 customers without power in downtown Davenport as of 5:45 p.m. Tuesday. By around 6:25 Tuesday evening, Mid-American's map showed around 125 customers in Davenport without power. The estimated restoration time was 9:15 p.m. Another article, a local one. Geneseo woman gets 8 years. She's sentenced for a fatal DUI crash. Written for us by Tom Lowy. A judge sentenced a Geneseo woman to 8 years in prison for killing Cecilia Nash in a 2021 drunk driving crash. Brittany Griswold, 37, was given the sentence by 14th District Judge Peter Church in a Rock Island courtroom after a plea agreement was reached last year. Griswold pleaded guilty on November 27, 2021, to a single count of aggravated driving under the influence, according to Rock Island County Court records. Griswold also faced another count of aggravated DUI and 1 count each of reckless homicide and unlawful possession of a stolen vehicle. As part of the plea agreement, the Rock Island County State's Attorney's Office dropped those other charges at sentencing. The crash occurred just after midnight on August 8, 2021 at 2311 78th Avenue West, authorities said. Nash, a Rock Island resident, was 49. Griswold's bail was set at $50,000, but she was released on her own recognizance without having to post a bond. Represented by former judge and prosecutor Larry Vandersmick, Griswold did not spend a day in jail. She was fingerprinted and photographed for a mugshot a year after the crash, after multiple requests from a Quad City Times reporter, according to previous reporting. There were two other criminal filings related to the crash. In Rock Island County, police initially cited Griswold with DWI, while Henry County prosecutors charged her with unlawful possession of a stolen vehicle. Authorities dropped both of those cases in 2022, records state.
Scholarships. Trinity College of Nursing and Health Sciences and Partners gave a total of $244,500 in scholarships to future healthcare professionals last week. Scholarships were awarded to 47 students at Trinity's annual recognition dinner last Wednesday, funded through Trinity Health Foundation and Friends of Trinity. Our donors' decision to support students has a powerful impact on our community, and the number of scholarships tells you how strongly our community believes in the future of healthcare, said Trinity Health Foundation President Mary McCumber Schmidt. For many students, an education may not be possible without considerable financial support. You are enabling them to achieve their dreams and continue to strengthen our community. Nurse practitioner Babina Mubari of Unity Point Clinic Express Care in Bettendorf gave the event's keynote address. She earned her bachelor's degree from Trinity in 2018 and then her master's from Bradley University in 2023. Trinity students Savannah Connor and Ethan Hong delivered the student addresses, which focused on generosity of others. Friends of Trinity is a volunteer fundraising and outreach organization that supports Unity Point Health, Trinity across the community. With more than 270 members, Friends of Trinity has donated more than $4.4 million grant dollars over the past 30 years. The Trinity Health Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit that works with Unity Point Health, Trinity team members, and community donors to secure charitable gifts. In 2023, the foundation funded over $1.1 million for patient assistance, community outreach, equipment and supplies, capital projects, and continuing education for the health system. For more information on these scholarships, contact Trinity Health Foundation at 563-742-7610 or email foundation@unitypoint.org. One more short little story before we go to the obituaries. Woman found deceased in Moline identified. A woman found deceased on Moline 7th Street early morning has been identified as Amy Beth Raines, 45, of Moline, Rock Island County Coroner Brian Gustafson said. An autopsy was performed Tuesday, found no anatomical cause of death, Gustafson said, adding that no foul play is suspected. He added that the woman had a significant medical history that could have contributed to her death. At 4:30 a.m. Monday, Moline police received a 911 call from a passerby at 3400 block of 7th Street to check the welfare of a woman lying alongside the roadway. Raines had been reported missing by her family Sunday afternoon. The circumstances of her missing were not suspicious, but the family was concerned about her well-being. Police canvassed the area looking for a witness or video surveillance. Gustafson said the investigation is continuing between the coroner's office, Moline Police, and the Illinois State Police Crime Scene Division. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Moline Police Department at 309-797-0401.
Thank you, Pam. It's time for the obituaries. I'm going to start with the pendings. Carolyn D. Anderson, 80, of Moline, passed away April 2nd at Overlook Village Senior Living in Moline. Arrangements are pending at Estradel Mortuary and Crematory Limited in Moline. Edmund C. Gothals, 83, of East Moline, passed away Monday, April 1st at his home. Arrangements at Van Ho Funeral Homes in East Moline. Diane Salmon, 74, of Davenport, passed away Monday, April 1st at her home. Arrangements at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. And Wesley F. Williams, 88, formerly of DeWitt, passed away Sunday, March 31st at home in Walcott, Iowa. Arrangements at Schultz Funeral Home in DeWitt. And Mary Louise Brophy. It is with sadness that we announce the passing of our family's matriarch, Mary Louise Brophy, on Tuesday, April 2nd. She can now join our dad, her husband, John, in heaven. A visitation will be held from 9 until 10 a.m. Saturday, April 6th at St. Anthony's Catholic Church with a massive Christian burial at 10 a.m. She will be laid to rest at Calvary Cemetery in Sterling, Illinois. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Memorial may be made to St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Mary was born December 6, 1937, to Stanley and Helen Puda Glaub in Mystic, Iowa. She graduated valedictorian in 1956 from Mystic High School. Mary married John T. Brophy on June 6, 1959. They enjoyed over 64 years of marriage before John's death on April 25, 2023. Mary and her late husband raised 6 children. She has 10 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. She was a proud stay-at-home mom. At the same time, she served as vice president of a company that her husband established, Quad City Water Technology. A special tribute came when Mary was crowned Irish Mother of the Year in 2005. Mary was also a talented seamstress. Surviving are her children, Joseph Carol Brophy, Bettendorf, and Ann and Bob Klingberg of Rock Island, Michael Patricia Brophy in North Carolina, Thomas Denna Brophy, Geneseo, Bridget Graves Bettendorf, and Matthew Brophy in Florida. And she has 10 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren, and her sister Georgia in Dubuque. In addition to her husband, she was preceded in death by her parents and siblings, Frank Glaub, Stanley Glaub, and Valerie Walker. The family wants to thank the caring staff at Senior Star Memory Care, Moms Fresenius Dialysis Team, and Genesis Hospice, especially Lisa Levy and her dear friend Mary Hancock. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting hmd-funeralhome.com.
Philip Robert Hayes passed. passed away peacefully on Saturday, March 30th, after a courageous 2.5-year battle with cancer. He was 73 years old. Visitation will be held at Pape Funeral Home on Thursday, April 4th, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. A mass will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, April 5th, at Prince of Peace Parish, with burial to follow at St. Ignatius Crematory. Pallbearers will be his grandchildren. The family would like to express their gratitude for the incredible care Phil received from the medical teams of Mercy 1, the University of Iowa Comprehensive Cancer Center, and the Alverno Skilled Care Unit. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation in Phil's name to the American Cancer Society or St. Jude's. Online condolences may be left at www.papefh.com. Christine Lee Schnell passed away peacefully at her home on Saturday, March 30th. She was born on March 30th, 1953, the daughter of Warren and Elaine Schneff. Chris graduated from Central High School and worked for many years at the family's own Schneff's Jewelers. She had a heart of gold and provided loving care for her father and mother as they aged at home. Her heart shined ever more brightly when she began caring for Schuyler Weber. Family members include Frank and Ann McCarthy, Barbara Schneff, Janet Trussell, and Karen White. We also want to thank Mary Priester, her best friend, and John Kroger for caring for her. We are also grateful for the dedicated staff at Genesis Medical Center and Hospice Care. Per her wishes, there will be no services. Her ashes will be spread at the family cabin in Hayward, Wisconsin. Hodge, 83, of Eldridge, passed away at Genesis East on March 29th. Memorial services are 12:30 p.m. Friday, April 5th, at Chambers Funeral Home in Eldridge. Visitation will begin at 11:30 a.m. Burial will follow at Rock Island National Cemetery. He retired from the U.S. Army at the rank of colonel. He continued working as a contractor at the Rock Island Arsenal. Survivors include his wife Susan and stepson Christopher, and his wife Mary Beth Myers of Davenport. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the North Scott Rotary. Warren's full obituary may be visited at www.mcginnis-chambers.com. Jack Clifford Luth, 85, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on April 1st at Northbrook Manor Center, Care Center in Cedar Rapids. As per his wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, April 5th, at Wirtz Funeral Home. Private interment will take place at Davenport Memorial Park Cemetery. Online condolences may be expressed at www.weirsfh.com. Jack was born on February 12, 1939, in Davenport, to Carl and Rachel Hughes Lewith. He was united in marriage to Carol Ann Murphy Lewith on July 21, 1962. She preceded him in death on October 19, 2021. Jack was a heavy equipment operator and worked as an auto mechanic. He served in the National Guard in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, from 1956 to 1957. He enjoyed stock car racing since he was 16 years old. He also loved fishing, camping, tinkering, snowmobiling, farming, and spending time with family and friends. He also enjoyed traveling, as Hawaii being their favorite spot to visit. Jack loved his dogs, George and Bailey. Jack was never one to pass up a good donut or a sweet treat. Survivors include his children, Dale Lewith, Sean Lewith, grandchildren Amanda Palmer, Nick Lewith, Jacob Lewith, Ryan Lewith, and Alex Lewith. 4 great-grandchildren and brother John Lewith. Jack was preceded in death by his parents, wife Carol, infant son Charles, sister Charlotte Stoltenberg, and brothers Bill and Mike Lewith.
from Clarence, Joseph A. Benny. Joseph A. Benny, 100 of Clarence, formerly of Oxford Junction, passed away on Sunday, March 31st at Clarence Senior Living. A visitation will be held Thursday, April 4, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Dawson Funeral Services in Oxford Junction. Her funeral mass will be held Friday, April 5th at 10:30 a.m. at the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Oxford Junction. Burial will be at Mayflower Cemetery. And if you would like to view a full obituary, you can find it at DawsonFuneralHome.com. Walcott. Jean Potter, 81, of Walcott, passed away Saturday, March 30th. A celebration of life will be held between 1 and 3 p.m. on Saturday, April 6th, at the Runge Mortuary and Crematory, Davenport. Cremation rites have been accorded. She will be laid to rest at a later date in Forest Home Cemetery in Michigan. Oh, I'm sorry, in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. She was united in marriage. Jean was born on November 30th, 1942, in Mount Pleasant to Stanley and Ruth Looker. She was united in marriage to her husband of 61 years, Robert Potter, on August 12, 1962, in Mount Pleasant. Jean was a media specialist at Wright Elementary in Cedar Rapids before retiring in 1998. After retirement, Bob and she delivered flowers together. She was a long member of Newcomb Presbyterian Church in Davenport. She was a great coach's wife for 38 years, and her family was her greatest joy. Jean is survived by her husband, Bob Potter of Walcott, daughters Nancy, Karen of Davenport, Lindsay, Ben, Andrew, Josh, and great-grandchildren Liam and John McCraw, sister-in-law Joanne Looker, and several nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents and brother Richard Looker. Nancy Lynn Zeski, September 10, 1944 to March 30th. Lynn was born on September 10, 1944 to James and Margaret Miller Condon in Paintsville, Ohio. She married Russell Zesley Jr. in Ohio in 1968. Lynn was a member of the Lago Marcinos team for 31 years. The relationship she formed while working with the extended Lago Marcinos family and customers were special to her. Her passion was decorating the store windows for every holiday. She curated upwards of 100 windows to the finest detail, for which she was recognized in the Moline Dispatch. Children and adults alike would stop to enjoy the holiday scenes that Lynn crafted. She was an avid collector and treasure hunter who cherished her teddy bear and chair collections. Lynn was a lover of animals, her own dogs and cats as well as the neighborhood animals. She especially enjoyed spending time with her grandchildren, playing games, reading stories, and making art. And she died on Saturday, which was March 30th. Wieland Presley Funeral Home and Crematory, Rock Island, is assisting the family. Those left to cherish her memory include her husband of 53 years, Russ Zeski, her sons, Jason and Ryan, several grandchildren, her brother, Jimmy Condon, and cousin, Christine Nestor. She was preceded in death by her parents, James and Margaret Condon, and sister, Jo Masters, online condolences, memories, and expressions of sympathy may be left for the family at WhelanPresley.com. And lastly, we have Nate D. Weaver, August 30th, 1979 to March 21st. Nathan Nate D. Weaver, 44, of Davenport, passed away in his home on Thursday, March 21st. Born August 30th, 1979, in Bitburg, Germany, he was the son of Daniel C. and Christy A. Weaver. As a military brat, Nate grew up in Alabama, Texas, and Germany. While the family was stationed in Germany for much of the 1990s, he attended Kaiserslautern American High School, graduating in 1998. He formed lifelong friendships during this time and developed a passion for playing the drums and soccer. Nathan graduated with a Bachelor of Business Administration from the University of the Incarnate Word in 2003. He moved to Louisiana for a few years before settling in Davenport. He started his own real estate business and got married in 2017. In 2018, he obtained a Master of Arts in Biblical Studies from Moody Bible Institute, his most cherished accomplishment was being a father following the birth of his son Daniel in 2018 and daughter Hannah in 2020. Nate was actively involved in the Celebrate Recovery ministry at Edgewood Baptist Church, playing drums at CR gatherings and at weekend services. He is survived by his children, Daniel and Hannah, his father, Daniel, and stepmother, Cecilia, his mother, Christy, and stepfather, Paul, his brother, Carl, sister, Keegan, brother, Jackson, and nieces, Scarlett and Oriah, and nephew, Costas. Memorial services for Nate will be 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th at Edgewood Baptist Church, Rock Island. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Whelan Presley Funeral Home is assisting the family. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation in memory of Nathan to the Celebrate Recovery Ministry at Edgewood Baptist Church. Online condolences may be left for the family at WhelanPresley.com.
Okay, turning now to the opinions of the Quad City Times. Here is an article written by Mary Mendenhall, calling, and the title of this article is "Working to Make Illinois Best State to Raise Kids." In October, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced an ambitious plan to unify all of Illinois' early childhood programs and funding into a single agency. Agency unification is another step toward Governor Pritzker's goal of making Illinois the best state in the nation for families raising young children. "I'm proud to have been appointed the 18-member early childhood... I'm proud to have been appointed to the 18-member Early Childhood Education and Care Transition Advisory Committee that will collaboratively guide this transition over the next 2 years and help Illinois to be more equitable, efficient, and effective with state resources. I'm there to advocate for our employees, the people we support, the communities we serve, and the solutions we champion by giving voice to more than 250 SAL employees, more than 800 children that we serve daily, countless families in our region that depend on accessible, high-quality child care, and the early childhood education and child care providers who make that care possible. The current Illinois early childhood system is complex and difficult to navigate for families and early care and education providers with different eligibility requirements and multiple monitoring and compliance policies across three different Illinois agencies, Illinois Department of Human Services, Illinois State Board of Education, and Illinois Department of Child and Family Services. Our families and early childhood educators bear this burden while balancing the demands of everyday life. Voting yes to create the Department of Early Childhood Action will enhance services to families and early education and care providers by building a comprehensive and streamlined system. It will also center racial equality and provide resources for data collection and timely public reporting. The Illinois General Assembly has an easy decision to make. Let's urge them to approve a new Department of Early Childhood so that our state's youngest children finally come first. And Marcy Mendenhall is president and CEO of SAL Community Services.
There's a cartoon here on the editorial page, and it's labeled Female Superheroes. There are three pictures. One, the first one is labeled Wonder Woman. She's standing there with her arms crossed, as usual. The second one is Supergirl, with her left hand raised in a salute. And the third box is a young woman holding a basketball in her left hand, and on her shirt it says Iowa 22. It's Caitlin Clark. All righty, now, World War II veterans, in a letter, likely turning in their graves over GOP. About a month ago, I submitted the following to Marionette Miller Meeks on her congressional website. I am 70 years old. My father fought in World War II. I would suggest to you that he and hundreds of thousands of others, veterans of that war, are spinning in their graves. As the GOP blocks military aid to Ukraine, citizens of that free nation are dying every day in a desperate fight for that freedom, which they are now starting to lose because of your party's fealty to a malevolent narcissist who cares nothing about the foundations of our country, its position of leadership in the world, or our national security. Is your lust for power and position so strong that these things matter less? Putin is evil and Trump admires and wants to emulate him. This world is in a more dangerous situation than at any point since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the powers are arrayed much like the late 1930s. Why did you go to Congress? What does leadership mean to you? I received no response. Perhaps she took it as rhetorical. I didn't mean it that way. It's written for us by Bill Waltz of Davenport. And then there's one more that I'll read real quick. Quantity Time shows bias by omission. On March 15, Tom Martin claimed, "There is no bias in Quantity Time's reporting." Obviously, Mr. Martin doesn't understand that omission is a form of bias. On March 20th, Congress held one of the most important hearings on the Biden crime family investigations. Is it possible that the Times editors have never heard of Tony Bobulinski, and therefore their readers are not informed about one of the biggest stories of the year that can affect the 2024 presidential election? It seems the Quad City Times considers itself among the elite media providers, since CNN and the other liberal mainstream news channels also participated in the cover-up. It seems the Quad City Times has no intention of providing a fair and balanced news source for our area. The Times seems to assume they can enlighten their uninformed readers. When the Times withholds facts, their readers aren't in danger of researching and reaching a different conclusion than the bias the editors wish to sell. No wonder so many eschew your liberal content. Oh well, there is always the Wall Street Journal. But alas, there is hope for the basket of deplorables. At least we'll know all of the trivia answers to the front page news about rock concerts. Written for us by Fred Dodds of Bettendorf. As Pam just reminded me, that brings us to the end of Quad City Times for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. And you can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, first and only radio reading services.